wished by the late Imam Khomeini and also the Rahbar now would not be achieved, brother.
Very true. I think
because now we could see that in leading a society and in ruling a society nowadays, we could see the signs and the footsteps of capitalism in our society, brother.
Yeah.
This is not at all Islamic. The banking system, the interest rate, the stock markets. The name is Islamic, but the system is not, brother.
When we are talking about actually these indexes that we have been talking from the early minutes of this show, actually we did not want to ignore all the problems and deficiencies that we have. No one can ignore all, for example, pressures that are coming and imposed from outside towards Iran, or even the mistakes that we have. No, these are not just to justify everything. We actually made a comparison in some aspects, in some actually levels with our previous regime. So it does not mean that our banking system needs to be modified and corrected and it has lots of problems. Mm-hmm. It does not mean that, for example, there is no poverty, as I said, at all. But the general movement of this society towards the social justice looks sane.
And looks good.
Looks good.
I think there is the best thing about this revolution, that even the Supreme Leader has said, I'm a revolutionary.
Yes.
These things, the things that you have said, yes. Like the systems that were developed in this country was from the revolution.
Yeah.
And the good thing about this revolution is that it's going on. It has not stopped. It has not said that we have achieved everything.
Yes.
The difference between this revolution and the rest of revolutions that happened in the world was that the rest, whenever they had their, like, they got the governments or the power, they were in the power, they said, we achieved our goal. But this revolution is still saying we haven't reached to our goal.
Okay.
We need to go forward. And that's the best thing. And that's why it's creating many more systems within it to make things perfect.
That's right. And that spirit must be kept, you know, and the new generation must understand this, especially in Iran. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Ali Alavian, for your nice elaboration regarding the social, of course, it was socioeconomic justice in Iran after the 1979. We say we are not still talking about a very ideal land. We are elaborating on a comparison made between the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the regime before that, before 1979, and the developments that Iran made after 1979. Thank you much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Do not forget to visit our website at parstrade.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
كان وقام الإمام قام الإمام
قام الإمام
وقامت مرايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام
قام الإمام
جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام
وقامت أسودا تلبي الحمين نداء السماء وغيث الغمام
وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with Nico Vitahwayo on this week's show. We'll be looking at the economic war between China and the U.S., particularly focusing on the tussle for the top of the world's largest economy ladder, something that appears to be about to change. Will the impact of the COVID-19 virus has, of course, played its part in the world's economy, yet it seems that the recovery time from the depression caused is something that could be a factor in just how individual economies pick up again, with China seeming to lead the way as it bounces back from the financial impact seen in the year 2020. But it's not just the COVID-19 pandemic that has seen economies rise and fall. As from back in 2010, the Chinese economy began to exponentially gain on the U.S. economy, chart from the CEBR World Economic League table, which also shows that by the year 2028, the Chinese economy will catch up with and surpass that of the U.S. Naturally, China excels when it comes to foreign exports and is hence a major factor in why it is able to recover so well. Yet, as things settle down in China, it is the domestic market that also sees China take an advantage over the U.S., as we can see in this chart over here. Retail sales in China are rising faster than those of the U.S., which is still seeing lockdowns and closures prevent its economy recovering as fast as that of China. Now, in order to take a deeper look into just what is happening on the Sino-American economic fronts, let's get straight into our first report, which addresses the issue on a deeper level.
The race is on for the world's largest economy as global nations emerge slowly but surely from the devastating effect of the COVID-19 pandemic that rocked economies and cost lives around the world. The two current largest global economies, the United States of America and China, remain locked in horns as per prior to the arrival of the virus. But now it seems, as the world sets out its agenda to recover, is just how fast each nation will be back on its feet, and is something that will no doubt determine just how quickly China catch up with and eventually surpass the US as the world's largest economy.
Before the pandemic, there was clear evidence that China was going to surpass the US in terms of its size of GDP. And on some measures, or GDP measured as purchasing power parity, China had already done that in 2019. So the pandemic itself wasn't the reason for this. This was already happening.
Whereas China has demonstrated that it's been able to successfully return into the black following the pandemic, with factories and shops opening up again and lockdown measures all but eradicated, the opposite is true in the United States, which is still seeing its economy struggle to return to pre-pandemic levels, and is something that will no doubt hinder the rate in which they finally do recover. Furthermore, the US under the leadership of ex-President Donald Trump made it a daily routine to put America first, making sure that its internal economy was the priority, almost ignoring the notion of multilateral trade, something that China has done with great interest, with examples being the Global Belt and Road Initiative and the signing of the regional RCEP agreement, which saw China boost its regional economic sway.
Multilateral trade systems is the answer to promoting world GDP, and also forestalling any kind of military or economic frictions. So, yes, I think trade is the solution to many of the world's problems. The more interdependent we become, the less likely we want to start fighting each other.
With predictions suggesting that the US and China will meet economic parity in 2028, the world, and in particular the US, will be keeping a keen eye on other emerging economic powers, such as India and Russia, as they edge their way up the table, potentially one day pushing the US further down the economic leaderboard.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. Mahan, welcome.
Pleasure.
And we have our special guest, Ming Du. He's a professor of Chinese law and trade and current director of the Center for Chinese Law and Policy at Durham University. Professor, many thanks for being with us today. First up, the U.S. and China, they're jostling for the top spot as the world's largest economy. Now, are we set to see a change in the status quo, do you think? Or is the global financial complex on a radically different route inspired by recent global events?
Thank you for having me today, Kavi. My points to your question are basically two points. First, I think China's economic growth is unstoppable. Barring any major disruptions in international relations, I think China is on its path to the number one economy in the world. But that being said, we should not underestimate the U.S. resilience. Giving the historical examples, and U.S. has gone through some even worse major disruption, but somehow it recovered. So I think China is going to be number one, but it may take a little bit of time for China to achieve that spot. Thank you.
Well, Mahan, one of the main reasons that China seems to be catching up with the Americans in terms of at least their GDP growth rate, where it counts is the fact that they seem to have emerged from the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of people are talking about that much more quicker and more efficiently than the U.S. has. And, of course, this is being reflected in the economy. Do you think that the U.S. mismanagement is, in essence, the main reason for the Chinese exponential growth rates?
I think the key word here is resilience. The Chinese economy and more broadly the Chinese state and its society are just far more robust and resilient than their Western counterparts. I mean, let's face it, the West just fell apart in the face of this pandemic. Look at the UK, for instance. It has the highest death rate per capita in the world. The US is in disarray in terms of COVID-19. But China, where the virus supposedly originated from, has dealt incredibly well. It suppressed it very early on because it's a much more cohesive country. State and society work very well together.
This particular entry over here talks about how the first country hit by COVID-19, and it says it controlled the disease, but it did not need to repeat economically paralyzing lockdowns as European countries have done. So that, I think that's another important point here in terms of the lockdown, repeated lockdowns.
That speaks to preparedness, both on the part of the state and also on the part of society to accept very harsh measures very early on to get on top of a problem. The problem in the West, specifically Western Europe and North America, is that the society and the state were not in sync, you know.
Very well. Well, thank you so much for that. We do appreciate the comments made there by Mahana and, of course, the professor. Now, in terms of what we're going to see next in this next report that has been prepared, we're going to be hearing from both of them again later, but we're going to look at just how military spending may be having a negative effect on the American economy, something that China seems to have avoided to their advantage.
It can be argued that one of the main reasons that China is catching up with the US is based on two very important factors. The first is the most obvious, namely the way in which the country makes its money, which for China predominantly comes in the form of large manufacturing output, one that essentially sees China being labelled as the factory of the world. But the second factor, and one that may be overlooked by many, is how each nation spends its money. And this is where the real difference comes into play when it comes to comparing the US and China. Although the US enjoys a huge income from its well-established military-industrial complex, the US also spends more than any other nation on military hardware, in fact seeing the US spend over $732 billion in 2020, three times that of China on $261 billion. China, although the world's second largest military spending nation, has used much of its income in investment, in particular when it comes to the technology industry, proving that its research and development in the area has boosted its GDP by leaps and bounds, and is something that the US have attempted hard to curb in the implementation of sanctions against various Chinese tech companies, none more so famous than leading Chinese telecommunications company, Huawei. Furthermore, the One Belt, One Road initiative has seen China invest into infrastructure, logistics, and technology across the world, in fact touching over 140 countries, hence seeing China divert its funding away from the military complex and into investment and long-term strategies, something that has potentially boosted the Chinese economy like none other.
I think the Belt and Road initiative is more an extension of its economic power. In much the same way as the private sector expanded in the British Empire in the 19th century, this expansion of economic power is projected through the Belt and Road Initiative. What's needed in China to sustain its position as the largest economy and the most powerful economy is productivity in China. Trade will go some way towards that, as the Belt and Road Initiative is meant to support, but that in itself is not sufficient.
With the US clearly aware of the fact that China is fast catching up with it, various stalling methods have been placed against China, including the sanctions that we've just mentioned. But more worryingly, seeing the US stoke the flames of tension in places like Hong Kong and Taiwan, something that could cause a Cold War to rapidly warm up.
It could really depend very much on the miscalculation on either side, because for China, domestic consumption of its policy is extremely important, and therefore, if it looks as if they're being threatened by an outside force, their real worry for China is not so much the outside force, but what happens inside, and therefore, that would force them into acting militarily.
Back with me in the studio is Maan Abedin and Professor Ming Du from Durham University. Okay, we'll go to the professor, see what he has to say. Yeah. With this next question, Professor, the U.S. spending trillions of dollars in its military whilst China has concentrated on technological advances, boosting its economy in the process. Do you think the tech industry is China's catalyst to undermining the U.S.?
Kevin, it's true that China is spending millions and billions of dollars on its technology industry. Whether it will overtake the U.S. or undermine the U.S. in this respect, I believe is unclear. Well, the background of China's focus on technology is, of course, technology is China's Achilles heel. For example, China is still unable to produce its own semiconductor chips. The U.S. sanction against Huawei by prohibiting supply of chips has put a lot of pressure on China's national GNP. So, well, it's indeed a wake-up call for China's government to concentrate its resources on developing some core and key technology. And, well, will China succeed? I believe so. Given time, yes. But it takes time for China to sort out its technology problems and overtake the U.S. in that regard.
Well, Maan, we have to talk about, obviously, how the U.S. has taken great steps to curb the progress that's being made by the Chinese. And one of those was the way that it dealt with Huawei in terms of the way it restricted it, and there were many different facets of the restrictions that happened. Looking at what's said over here, they barred from doing business with Huawei due to national security concerns was the big reason that the U.S. brought, and also supplying equipment for network infrastructure to supply chains, et cetera. Do you think the U.S. made a concerted attempt, without holding back, to stop China advance technologically?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, under the previous administration, they did everything they could. And Huawei, I think, is actually the best example. They did two things in relation to Huawei. They actually put pressure on Canada to detain one of the executives of Huawei, and she's still under house detention, as far as I know. And more importantly, they applied so much pressure on the UK to cease all cooperation with Huawei, because Huawei was tasked with developing the UK's 5G network. And initially, the UK agreed to the deal, and then they reneged on it, saying that it can only have a peripheral role to play. And then the Brits even went further as a result of American pressure and said, we will terminate all cooperation with Huawei before the end of the decade.
Okay, thanks again to Maan on that. We do appreciate it, and of course, the professor. We're gonna, we have plenty more coming up, but right now we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavitawi. Time now to take a look into the U.S.-China economic sphere in more detail in our in-depth section. Now, as discussed throughout the show already, the COVID-19 pandemic has taken its toll on both the Chinese and the U.S. economies. But as we emerge from the pandemic, a report by the Center for Economics and Business Research suggests that the U.S. economy is expected to grow by around 1.9% annually between the years 2022 and 2024, slowing to 1.6% after that, whereas the Chinese economy is expected to grow by 5.7% annually until 2025, before settling in at 4.5% thereon. Moving on to the next one, as things stand, the U.S. and China are the top two largest economies in the world, with the U.S. enjoying a nominal GDP of $21.44 trillion compared to China's $14.4 trillion. However, when we look at the GDP per capita, due to China's large population, it would only require a GDP per capita half the size of that of the U.S. to see China's overall economy become twice the size of that of the U.S. Okay, on to the next one. It seems that it is not just China that is threatening the U.S. position as the world's largest economy, according to Standard Chartered Bank. Once the U.S. falls behind China, it will likely never be able to replace it again. It may even fall behind the rising economy of India. By the year 2030, 35% of the global GDP will be created in Asia, with six of the world's top 10 economies being found in that region. And now on to the next one. It seems the key to success for China is what is called the Belt and Road Initiative, which, unlike the U.S., has seen China avoid spending money on its military, instead investing in the global economy, with figures of between $50 to $100 billion a year being distributed into thousands of projects across Asia, Africa, Europe, and South America, yielding high returns in the process. Time now to take a look at our final report in this episode, as we look into how Sino-U.S. relations may look with a new U.S. president at the helm, one that appears to have already started reversing multiple decisions made by his predecessor, Donald Trump.
Many people, when asked whether Joe Biden will do a better job than Donald Trump when it comes to Sino-American relations, will likely answer words to the effect of, well, he couldn't do any worse. Yet is this really the case? The 46th president of the United States has already shown so much promise in reversing many of the policies set by his predecessor, as demonstrated by the pile of executive orders he signed on his first day in office. However, so far, none of the actions taken by Biden in his first days and weeks in office has pointed to any sign of change in U.S. relations with China. With Biden very much aware that the COVID-19 pandemic has slapped the U.S. economy harder than ever, as well as the notion that the nation he now presides over is more divided than ever, is the gentleman persona that Biden wishes to portray a false flag character, and does the mom and pop look hide the true Biden, who may well turn out to be nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing?
A wolf in sheep's clothing sounds like a good way of describing it. I don't think policy towards China is going to change radically. I think what's going to be different is the way it's going to be projected on the world press. And that's quite important for China, because face-saving policy is extremely important in their thinking. So it'll be a return to the sort of Roosevelt-type policy, that is Theodore Roosevelt policy, that is to speak softly and carry a large stick. So the kind of policy that will be going will be one that will be less confrontational, but it certainly will be challenging China.
But for Joe Biden, the U.S.-China relationship is not something that can just be brushed under the carpet, with the world clearly having to take multiple issues more seriously than ever, be it the environment, security, trade, and of course global health. The U.S. have indicated that both patience and consultation with allies is key as to how the relationship may play out over the next 4 years.
We're starting from an approach of patience as it relates to our relationship with China. So that means we're going to have consultations with our allies, we're going to have consultations with Democrats and Republicans, and we're going to allow the interagency process to work its way through to review and assess how we should move forward with our relationship.
What now remains to be seen is just how patient the U.S. can be. There's no doubt that China is fast on the way to replacing the U.S. as the world's largest economy, and should other Asian nations follow suit, it could be more of a problem than expected for the U.S. However, if there's one thing that Joe Biden will want to leave as an early legacy of his presidency, it's the notion of undoing the mistakes of Trump, be this at home in reuniting his polarized country, or across the international arena where Trump haphazardly lost the United States so many admirers and friends.
Back for the final time with us on this episode of Economic Divide is Mahan Abedin and also Professor Ming Du. Okay, let's go straight to the professor. Professor, my last question to you, looking to the future of the Sino-U.S. relations. Joe Biden at this point has taken the helm there in the U.S., reversed many of Donald Trump's policies. Do you think that he will work towards reversing the U.S.-China decoupling policy that was set by Donald Trump, hence easing the ongoing trade war in the process?
No. I think that Biden, Biden has a lot of differences with Donald Trump, but towards China policy, I think Biden has a very similar view against China. With that being said, Biden is going to continue the competitive pressure on China. But Biden might adopt a different strategy. For example, Trump may prefer the unilateral stance against China, but Biden will make alliances with other countries, both with Europeans, with Japan, with other of its allies against China to organize a united front against China. I think that competition and rivalry between China and the United States will continue within Biden administration the period.
Okay, Professor Ming Du from the University of Durham, many thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Kelly. Thank you.
Sure. Well, Mahan, it can't be argued that Donald Trump created such a toxic environment when it came to China and also the U.S. It's going to be hard for Biden to make some changes. I mean, we're yet to see really any motions forward by Biden in terms of China. What are we going to see when it comes to Biden making a difference in this whole scenario? Basically, when you take a look at the policy that is put forward, we know the pivot is there, and it's going to remain there in that sphere. But the trade deal is one of the things that needs to be looked at, and this is among the issues that, at this point, the U.S. is reviewing. What direction is it going to take?
Well, you know, Sinophobia is deeply entrenched in the psyche of the U.S. government machinery. So even if Biden wanted to reverse some of Trump's policies in relation to China, I think he's going to find that extremely difficult to pull off. And look, I mean, China, I believe, is going to surprise everybody. I mean, hitherto, China is simply focused on developing its economy, having this global economic reach, without that necessarily translating into diplomatic pull or even military might. But that's about to change. I mean, we saw China being extremely determined to assert full sovereignty over Hong Kong in the face of enormous resistance and pressure from the Americans and the British. But in the end, nothing happened. China asserted full sovereignty, and all the British can do is to give UK passports to their supporters in Hong Kong so they can flee. And you know, whilst the US is focused on these parochial trade issues, trying to hold Chinese technological progress, I think China will just surprise everybody and simply change the weather.
They've made their point clear. We'll have to see how the US is going to take this. I'm sure the US is going to continue down this path. Yeah. Time will tell. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it, Mahan. Thank you for your input, Mahan Ahmadine there. And also, I'd like to thank the director of the University or the Center for Chinese Law and Policy at Durham University, Professor Ming Du, for being on the show. As we enter a new multipolar world order, the way in which nations act and react with each other takes the stage on a host of levels. Whereas traditional competition may have come in the form of military might, today the world sees a combination of many factors, ranging from military, economic, and regional competition, which all play their part in the global arena. For China and the U.S., the Cold War is being fought at an economic level, with a host of tactics being thrown into the ring, including blocking Chinese technology under the shady cloak of national security, to the proxy Cold War is being fought in Hong Kong and in Taiwan, both of which have seen heavy U.S. influence in their ongoing sagas. What now remains to be seen is how the situation will play out as China goes from strength to strength, and the U.S. opens a new chapter in its policy towards China with the new man in the White House. That's all the time we have for this episode. Don't forget, we want to hear your thoughts on this or any other topic. So do get in touch with us by writing to us. In the meantime, you have from me, Kovit Tavwe, and the whole team here on Economic Divide. Stay safe.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe. Ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagya.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today, in these days, mark the anniversary of the victory of Islam after an era of darkness covering the entirety of the earth. These days are the days that the light of the Ahlul Bayt, the light of the Imam of our time, started to shine on the earth again through the revolution of the Ahlul Bayt, the Islamic revolution, and establishing in one part of the world, starting in that part of the world, the Islamic government, the government of the 12th Imam, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala, when He gives a blessing, then with it comes responsibilities. There's rizq that's coming to us through the revolution. Real Islam, true Islam, all these are rizq from Allah. Kulu, take it, wala tatghaw. Don't disobey. Don't rebel. What are we supposed to do? We've got to support it by openly being in support of that government, saying this is our government, saying this is an Islamic government, saying that we are under the leadership. This is our responsibility. This is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants from us today. Let me explain a little bit why that is our responsibility in light of the future and the past. What's the future? The future is this revolution encompassing the globe. Eventually it will. That's what we have from our ahadith. It's been foretold. We have been told about this. This was the beginning of the revolution of the Imam of our time. This is very clear. Anyone who does a little bit of research and think about it, put the ahadith and verses together, it's very clear. So this is going to, that's the future. The past, how did this happen? How did the revolution happen? The revolution did not happen because there were armed groups fighting the regime. That was not what brought the regime to its knees. Read the history of the revolution. Imam Khomeini did not tell some of those groups that were really believers and they were mujahideen who were fighting the system and they were taking out some major figures from the Shah's regime. They had supplied themselves and trained themselves with arms and they took out certain figures. Imam Khomeini didn't tell them what you're doing is haram. But Imam Khomeini didn't encourage that. That's not what he did. I'm not going to, you guys do whatever you think is right. That's your thing. But that wasn't what brought the regime to its knees. When Imam Khomeini started, he didn't say go out and kill the police or go out put bombs here and there. He didn't do any of that. He addressed the Shah and he said, what you're doing is wrong, and people know that what is happening is wrong, and we should stand for Islam, stand for Allah. That's what he said. People came out next day on the streets in Qom and in Varamin, close to Tehran, a smaller town close to Tehran. People came out with their kafans. They were killed. Imam Khomeini was in prison. Imam Khomeini continued speaking, people coming out, some of them killed, some of them imprisoned. Imam Khomeini continued speaking. The numbers of supporters of this ideology, this belief in Iran started to grow. A year before the revolution succeeded, because of this work, when Imam Khomeini's son passed or he was assassinated, and they started holding big programs in Iran, the Shah had an article written to disrespect Imam Khomeini. The article was published. The people of Qom came out in large numbers against the Shah. That's all they did. Again, they didn't bomb anywhere. They didn't pull out arms. They didn't do that. They came out on the streets in large numbers against
the Shah and against his command and against that cartoon and against that article that was published in that newspaper. The Shah came, cracked down on them, killed a number of them. News got out. The people of Tabriz and other cities, but the largest one was the people of Tabriz. 40 days later, on the Arba'in of the Shuhada, they learned from Imam al-Hussein's family, Arba'in, holding Arba'in of Shuhada. When you're in a movement against a tyranny, they held the Arba'in in Tabriz. People in Tabriz were killed. The Arba'in of the Shuhada of Tabriz was held in multiple cities. The largest congregations and the largest crackdown was in Yazd, another major city in Iran. Then it continued, and then day after day, it started picking up more and more momentum. In what way? Support of the people coming out. Imam Khomeini telling them, you need to come out and support and chant against the Shah. In Muharram, the Muharram programs, while Imam al-Hussein's name is mentioned, connecting it to that day, connecting it to their time, and connecting Yazid to their time. And so all those processions of Muharram were the largest processions against the Shah. And they killed them, but they continued coming. Again, bombing, guns, no. What support? Showing that support, coming out on the streets when it was needed to come out on the streets. When Imam Khomeini told them, we need to shut down industries in Iran, the workers shut down. When they supported, they didn't say we're going to come out in arms. Imam Khomeini said, the workers, the oil company workers, they shut down the oil company facilities, and so oil was not being exported. The car industry companies, the workers did not go to work. Other businesses, some for 50 days, they shut down their business for 50 days, 2 months almost, until Imam Khomeini came and the revolution succeeded. Support in these ways. People need to join. In the early days, the numbers of people were small, and the Shah thought there's no threat here. Or when he felt the threat, exile. They tried to sentence Imam Khomeini to death. Again, the people supported, ulama supported. They couldn't do that. They sent him to exile. Thought they could get rid of that. Imam Khomeini continued. People started supporting more and more. The numbers of people started supporting. The level of support increased. And the revolution succeeded. The global revolution needs the same thing. The global revolution needs the exact same thing, the exact same pattern.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
This is a part of a speech delivered on January 16th, 1980, by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini. Subject, Most Superior Migration from Carnal Desires. Migration carries a great meaning of all migrations. The migration from self-conceit and riding of selfishness, egoism, and migration from oneself towards God is the greatest of migrations. The migration of Prophet from Mecca to Medina aimed to show men the way of migration from oneself towards Allah. Teachings of Prophets are for this migration so that we migrate from darkness, gloom, selfishness, carnal passions towards Allah and defecting from ourselves and our satanic desire and turn towards Allah the Almighty.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We were talking about the relationship between the religion and politics in viewpoints of Imam Khomeini and how Imam Khomeini thinks about the politics and religion. Being a religious person, he worked perfectly in the field of politics as well, so that he could have this revolution, the revolution that we know as an Islamic revolution, not a Shi'i revolution, not a Sunni revolution. It's an Islamic revolution, and that's what we can see from the Imam Khomeini. It's because of his struggles. Now, apart from this, Imam Khomeini also believed that the society stands in need of an acceptable garment at all times, including the time of occultation. Now, why he was very much emphasizing on the Islamic state, why he is very much emphasizing on the garment, Islamic garment, being a religious person, it's because we have a hadith, and that hadith says, "An-nasu ala dini mulukihim." The people follow the religion of their leaders, the people follow the religion of their chiefs. So if the chief or the leader is the pure person, then the people will go towards the perfection. He has mentioned that the Islam has come to purify mankind. If in an Islamic state, the head of state is a purified person, he can take these people towards the purification. Being a Shia Muslim, we believe that Imam Mahdi, when he will come, he will bring the governorship of the justice. He will bring justice into the world. Why? Because he, being a leader, is the most just person, is the most just person on the earth. And that's why everyone will follow him. Imam Khomeini also had the same idea. He said, at the time of occultation, if Imam is not there, then his representative should be there, his successor, the one who Imam himself has introduced. And Imam has said that at the time of occultation, you must follow the scholars, the fuqaha, that are the representative of me. Inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to understand and to follow the teachings of Quran and Ahlul Bayt. Inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks in his first foreign policy speech included a handful of announcements and intentions, including Washington's decision to halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia in order to avoid the current humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen to be worsened. Biden condemned the Saudi-led war on Yemen, saying it has created a humanitarian and a strategic catastrophe and it has to end. Indeed, 6 years of war and blockade in Yemen has taken a heavy toll on the country. Thousands have lost their lives in the Saudi-led attacks, while millions lost their homes or abandoned them to run away from the horrors of war. But the degree which the U.S. was involved was confirmed by a New York Times article, facts that were not well known up to this point. The article stated that Saudi F-15 jets were not only serviced by American mechanics, but also American technicians upgraded the targeting software and other classified technology. Saudi commanders sat with American military officials who provided intelligence and tactical advice, which included dropping American bombs. UNICEF has called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 24 million in dire need of help. Washington has been the biggest arms supplier of Riyadh during the first 5 years of Yemen war, as it provided three-quarters of Saudi's arms imports. For Washington, halting arms sales to Riyadh is not a cost-effective decision, even though Biden has promised to do so. It appears that Biden is using a double standard policy. He claims he wants to end the Yemen war and stop selling arms to Riyadh, which means losing billions of dollars of income. Contrastingly, he promises to provide defensive support for Saudi Arabia to defend itself against Yemeni attacks. The Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to Biden's speech, saying that Yemenis do not trust Washington's words on ending the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Ansarullah also says the establishment of real peace in the war-hit country is only possible if the Saudi-led attacks and blockade end, signaling that Yemen seeks real action to solve the problem, not just words. Despite Joe Biden's show of reversing former U.S. President Donald Trump's foreign policy, it seems Biden is using a hypocritical policy in dealing with Yemen war.
Well, the situation in terms of Saudi Arabia and the war against Yemen has been going on now for several years. I don't think the Biden position is really any different, essentially, from the point of view of the Yemeni people who have been suffering. We have to remember, of course, this kind of terminology that's used about military hardware being used for defensive capabilities. No military hardware is made for defensive capabilities if it's being used against a population, as we've seen in the Yemen. So I don't anticipate there's going to be that much of a difference in terms of this policy decision from the point of view of whether the United States is supporting the Saudi regime or not.
In his first foreign policy speech, the U.S. President Joe Biden indicated that his administration will deal with Russia differently, saying the time of the U.S. ruling over in the face of Russia's aggressive actions, including election interference and cyber attacks, is over, and that Washington will not hesitate to raise the cost on Russia. The U.S. president made it clear that Washington is keen on pushing back Russian threats and human rights abuse. Biden also condemned detention of the Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny and called for his immediate release. He also urged Moscow to hold using force against opposition protests. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while the Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. It also backed police actions against what it calls unauthorized rallies. Biden made those remarks while his administration moved quickly to extend the New START arms control treaty with Russia. The extension of this landmark arms control treaty will limit the number of nuclear missiles and warheads each country can deploy. But how could Moscow and Washington reach this agreement despite their disagreements?
Their concern is China rather than Russia. For the United States, the situation in Russia is a bit of a sideshow. They're not really sure what's happening on the ground. We know there are elements from the United States who are trying to destabilize Russia as we speak, and the situation with Navalny is very fluid indeed. So I think the Russians are, in a sense, going about their business, and the Americans are waiting in the wings to see what happens. So I think really in terms of geopolitics, the Biden administration is much more concerned with China as a superpower, as what it would define as a challenge to U.S. hegemony. And I think with the situation in Russia, United States will be playing both sides of the game.
While the U.S. President Joe Biden claimed his administration policy to deal with Russia's foreign policy is head-on, Biden has shown a double-standard approach. On one hand, he denounces Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny's arrest, but on a wider scale, he rushes to reach an accord with Kremlin. With this hypocrisy in Washington's foreign policy, where does Biden's policy with Russia lie?
Italians are in the midst of a multifaceted crisis. Italy has been hit particularly hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, with one of the highest death tolls in the world. The Eurozone's third biggest economy is meanwhile suffering from one of the worst downturns in decades. And now, political chaos triggered by the collapse of the coalition government last week is making the situation much worse. Some say it is the most perilous time for Italians since World War II. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has brought in this man to try to resolve the situation and put Italy on the right track, Mario Draghi, former head of the European Central Bank. He received a mandate earlier this week to form a new coalition government. Hopes are high for Draghi to find a way forward.
Well, Mario Draghi certainly has the experience of high-level politics and is broadly respected by both politicians and by the population. The man who famously said, whatever it takes, is broadly credited with saving the euro following the last recession in 2008-2009 and the subsequent sovereign debt crisis. So he definitely has the respect of people. Whether that then can translate into forming but maintaining a government in Italy remains to be seen.
Italy's financial markets reacted positively to his sudden arrival on the political scene. The star technocrat is extremely efficient under pressure. He steered the Eurozone through the financial crisis during his tenure as president of the European Central Bank. He is widely credited with saving both the Eurozone and the euro currency. His performance as the president of the European Central Bank became a source of national pride for Italians. The 73-year-old economist now has broad support among many major political parties. But Italian politics is a dangerous place, especially for technocrats and economists like him. After losing his Senate majority last week, Giuseppe Conte resigned as Italian prime minister. The crisis was triggered after a decision by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to withdraw his liberal Italia Viva party out of the centrist coalition government. Renzi was opposed to Conte's plan to spend well over 200 billion euros of EU recovery funds on the coronavirus crisis. Observers believe doubts about the outgoing government's ability to properly spend the money led to its collapse. But Draghi is widely believed to be capable of handling such sums because he is an experienced economist. But has he really got what it takes to be Italy's next prime minister? He is right now trying to unite as many political parties as he can. The former ECB chief wants to secure broad cross-party support because of the daunting challenges facing Italy.
Italy is particularly difficult to form and maintain a government. The main reason is that it usually requires a fairly broad coalition of a number of different political parties. What that does is put together people with competing ideologies or competing and differing views of how the government and indeed the country should be run. This creates a situation where the smaller parties actually have disproportionate amount of power.
So far, the center-left Democratic Party has given him its backing. Renzi's Italia Viva party has pledged unconditional support for Draghi. Center-right Forza Italia, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, also suggested that it might be ready to help out. But the right-wing league insists that it will not support a government backed by Five Star. All eyes are on Draghi now. He is considered a hero for the Eurozone. Can he unite the Italians at this time of crisis?
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved. It's attacked forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just, at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon.